trainings are coming up, and we could really use your help. You'll meet KPFT listeners just like you and help this community radio station. Your efforts make a difference and can make this a fun, fast, and successful drive. We hold phone volunteer training regularly to accommodate all kinds of schedules. Visit kpft.org for a complete list of training dates. If you are a seasoned phone volunteer, call 713-526-4000 to sign up for a volunteer shift. You're tuned in to Pacifica Radio, kpft.org, twitter.com/kpft, facebook.com/kpft Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of Technology Bites.
Somebody let the air out of Flicked.
Minecraft Creeper.
All right, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicked.
I'm Barrett.
And he's...
Groove House.
All right, yay, another show. And with the... specter of fundraiser hovering over us starting next
week. I didn't even know.
I didn't see it coming. I feel like I got punched in the gut.
A little bit. We've got other big news, too. Because we drug our feet on like selecting a Dwight replacement inside the show. Station management kind of stepped in and replaced
Dwight.
Yeah,
there's a... You know, when we come to the studio in the evening and we gather in the lobby to get ready to do the show every Wednesday night. And by get ready, I mean, you know, just... sit there and twiddle our thumbs until Saeed is gone. You know, there's this... We all have kind of a place we sit. You know, there's this different spaces. And the space where Dwight used to sit when he was doing whatever he did to get ready for the show has been filled with a vending machine. It already has so much more to offer.
New Dwight says, please make another selection.
Dwight says exact change, please.
New Dwight says, I'm giving some money to charity. Yeah, and so
yeah,
that...
At least this one gives you something back when you give it money.
And so...
Rather than just empty promises.
So the table in the table that was there in the display case for KPFT Awards has been moved over to where Barrett used to sit. So he's been this...
Although there's a picture of Martin Luther King in there. So, you know, at least I've been replaced by someone honorable.
New Barrett says, I had a dream.
Old Barrett says, I had a dream too.
And I had a seat.
I had a seat.
I had somewhere to sit and drink my coffee.
So we've got that going on. I mean, that's big news for us. Wow, a Coke machine. That's some technology, right? And it's really garish too. It's bright and new, and it's got LED lights that illuminate the inside for all the glory.
It's air conditioned.
All the glory. Yeah, it's got a combination soda vending machine and snack vending machine. So you get refrigerated
chips and everything else.
Yeah. But it's really bright, and it's like you walk into the lobby of KPFT and it hurts. Just hurts. More so than usual too. All right, well, welcome to the show. We're glad you could tune in. I want you to realize that this is going to be your last opportunity for a few weeks to enjoy a fundraising-free episode of Technology Bites, so we hope you'll stick around and participate tonight. It'll be a good show. We've only got two fundraising episodes coming up in the following weeks, which is good. Usually it's three, so it's always nice when it's only two. It's even better when it's one.
If you get bored during this week, between shows, you could go to the KPFT website and use the tip jar and pledge ahead of time and maybe shorten up the time that we need to be on the air doing pledge drive stuff.
Yeah, does our offer still stand? We hit our goal, we go back to normal.
If we hit our goal before we do the show, yeah, any time we hit our goal for the evening, we will stop fundraising. So, yes. So, yes. So, yes. Please pledge. All right. All right, so visit us online at geekradio.com. That is where we keep all the information. I took the Adrian call from last week and put it into its own download. So if you're interested in hearing that delightful call again, it's available at geekradio.com to download, as is the entire show in a separate download. And you can hang out on IRC with us, irc.cuckoo.com, the channel Tech Bites. We hang out there. You can use your own IRC client. Go to irc.cuckoo.com, or you can use our client on the website, and that'll get you into the channel. Easy peasy. And the phone number is 713-526-5738 or 713-526-KPFT if you want to be on the air with us. Tonight we will be taking calls a little bit later in the show, so there's that. So you rode your motorcycle, Flick? Did you rode your motorcycle? Did you get your new one yet?
New.
No. Okay.
Did you buy one?
I got another one. Yeah, it's being shipped.
I saw the pictures on Facebook, and it said something about New York.
Yeah,
so I didn't know if you went on a trip and just thought it was a cool bike, or if you were looking at it, or what happened.
I've been looking at this one for like 4 or 5 months for a while, and it's quieter. Mm-hmm. So I've been going to work early and coming, come back
because you've
the
listened
show.
To it.
You know, well, no, I mean, just they're known for being quiet. It's an older bike. It's like an old BMW from the 70s. So
would have been cooler if you went and got it.
Yeah, I thought about going up there and trying to ride back, and that was kind of half the plan. But then they just keep getting snow dumped on
the cold.
Yeah. That shut that down.
It was like negative 10 degrees.
I could have them like bring it to Florida straight south, and I'll just like ride over, you know, ride back west on 10.
All right. Well, I don't really have much else to talk about here this evening. We are going to go ahead and go to San Antonio and do the Technology Bites info shot. Take it away, net neutrality info shot.
It's the Technology Bites info shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Well, Jay hit that one right. Obviously, kind of the biggest story right now is net neutrality. Although, in looking up stuff on it in preparation for the show, it looks like this either could be a really big deal or turn out to not be that big a deal. you know, there's sort of all kinds of positions on, you know, whether whether this is going to be a big thing or not. But basically, there was a court decision on net neutrality, and it sounds like basically the court invalidated the current setup that would maintain net neutrality. The best article I found was at recode.net, the new thing from former Wall Street Journal gadget guy, and then I'm going to forget his name. Anyways, but from that site, and they went to a they have an interview with Susan Crawford, who's a law professor who has been very focused on this subject. She's a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. And she's not an unbiased observer. The thing to say is, you know, she's been a critic of the companies that dominate broadband service, and she even has written a book about it. The biggest thing is, you know, I would assume if you're listening to this, you know what net neutrality is. But the quick summary is that everybody who – all these big companies that offer internet access, that they let whatever traffic come through their network as happens. And not charging different rates or disallowing traffic for – to take an example like Netflix. When you watch a Netflix movie, obviously that starts on whatever network Netflix is on and comes through your internet connection to you. So if your provider's AT&T, then without net neutrality, AT&T could say, well, you know, that's some nice bandwidth you're using there, Netflix. You owe us money about it. Conveniently forgetting that you pay them for access to this bandwidth as well. But anyway, so they would be able to choose and charge different rates to different companies and so on. It's Peter Kafka wrote the article at recode.net if you want to look it up and get the full info. But essentially, the FCC is supposed to manage this stuff and be in charge of it. And what Susan Crawford says is, quote, there was a decision 10 years ago by the FCC to deregulate high-speed internet access and service and not treat it like the telephone companies had been treated for the last 100 years. The assumption the FCC made was there would be so much competition that it would protect Americans and we wouldn't need regulation, unquote. And so that was how it was set up before. And Verizon challenged some later rules that the FCC made. There was a big uproar in 2007 when Comcast was found to be systematically blocking BitTorrent across their network. The president, you know, Obama promised that net neutrality would be one of the elements of his administration. So in 2010, the FCC adopted what it called the Open Internet Rules, which was supposed to limit the power of internet service providers to block or discriminate. And that's what Verizon challenged and won. The thing that, you know, Kafka asks, you know, the key thing, what happens next? And what Susan Crawford says is, quote, realistically, what will happen is that in order to have authority over high-speed internet access, the FCC is going to have to have clear statutory grant of power. It has that now. All it has to do is relabel these services, you know, internet carriage and that, as common carriage services, and it's likely that that's what they'll end up doing, unquote. So this could be as simple as some administrative paperwork and new rules. It apparently does not require Congress or any kind of, you know, intervention from the courts or anybody else. The rest of the article goes through some interesting things, which is, for instance, why Google and Facebook are quiet about this instead of being, say, on the side of net neutrality, because they basically have good partnerships and aren't worried about getting blocked by these big providers. Whereas Netflix is kind of in middle ground. And so it starts turning into companies on one side and all of us people who use internet connections on the other. And it should be interesting to see what happens. The main place where this battle is going to take place is the FCC. So keep an eye on it. We definitely will, and we will keep getting back to you with whatever we learn about it going forward. The other thing, when I was getting ready, there was sort of this absence. I was trying to figure out. It's like there weren't that many stories. You know, there wasn't a lot of new tech being announced. You know, CES was kind of not, you know, didn't have a lot of big stories come out of it as far as big things that you know, new releases or new stuff. It was all kind of more of the same. And then I thought about it as we were coming up to the show. There's not really any big – there's not a big Apple event coming up anytime soon. And so we've missed on the December, January, like – Apple rumor-thon, you know, where they start coming up with the, you know, that the next MacBook Pro will like hover and you know, iPhones will orbit your head and listen for voice commands, whatever other kind of bizarro rumors. I did find some, but we don't have the kind of mass production of them that you usually get when there's kind of Apple's competing with CES announcement thing. That normally there was something around in January. Well, there's not. And so it's just kind of not there, which it's been a lot of years in a row where there's been some kind of – where there's been plenty of Apple rumory stuff, which is usually pretty funny to cover. And there isn't now. On a different – totally different subject though, this one's very interesting, especially with this whole net neutrality thing. Google is going to release an update to the mobile version of Chrome, which promises to decrease data usage while you're browsing web pages by as much as 50%. That's pretty good, since you know you're talking about on your iPhone or your Android device or your tablet that's using maybe LTE and you're paying pretty premium for bandwidth. Google announced the upcoming changes to its browser Wednesday in a blog post, saying that Chrome's data compression and bandwidth management can reduce data usage by up to 50% while browsing the web on Chrome for Android and iOS. To reduce data usage, users must enable the data savings option in Chrome's settings menu. And after enabling it, the setting, you'll be able to see how much data you're saving each month. The update's set to roll out over the next few days. It'll be available for both Android and iOS. The iOS update will also include Google Translate, which translates web pages while browsing, which is already available on the desktop and Android versions of Chrome. For its part, the Android version of Chrome will add home screen shortcuts. So that's kind of cool. You know, cut down on the bandwidth. as you may have noticed, my cold is not completely gone, but it's a lot better than it was. You know, the other big thing besides net neutrality has, of course, been the stuff with the NSA, you know, tapping, you know, having metadata information about everybody's calls and getting to everybody's business, or presumably getting into everybody's business. Two companies announced a new product Wednesday that they are teaming up to create, quote, the world's first smartphone to put privacy and control ahead of everything else, unquote. The Black Phone, as it's called. Why didn't they go with Bat Phone? Anyways, the Black Phone, as it's called, will run off a security-oriented Android build called Private OS that's designed to give users, obviously, more privacy and control. It's Geek's Phone from Madrid, which developed the first Firefox OS developer handsets, is going to work with a company in Washington, D.C. called Silent Circle to build Black Phone. I guess Black Phone will be based in Switzerland. Phil Zimmerman serves as president of Silent Circle and is the creator of PGP. So there's somebody who has credibility for getting into privacy and, you know, for protecting privacy and all that. I mean, I don't think anybody has argued. I don't believe anyone said that the NSA has co-opted Phil Zimmerman or PGP. The number one priority in creating Black Phone is to uphold the objectives of privacy, unquote, said Zimmerman in a video introducing the smartphone. He says, it's not to serve some other business model of monetizing customer data, which seems to be half the sites on the internet's model for making money. Black Phone's website says the device will include tools to give users ownership of their digital footprint and presence while allowing them to securely make phone and video calls, send text messages, transfer and store files, and browse the web. Users can also anonymize traffic with a VPN. It should be available for pre-order February 24th at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. So that's not far off, a little more than a month, you know, 6 weeks from now. That is pre-order, so there's that. On Facebook rumors, they're rumored to be launching a Flipboard-esque news aggregating app this month, according to a report. The app known as Paper and rumored a number of times in recent months will be a mobile-based news reader in a magazine format that's set to be separate from the usual Facebook news feed, although it apparently shares a number of traits with that part of the social network. You know, I don't know if you haven't used Flipboard, if you have a tablet device, and you know, you might like Flipboard. I personally, I do use it, and I like the way that it presents, especially linked stories from, say, your Twitter feed and your Facebook feed. It turns them into a lot more looking like a magazine, and it shows them. It tends to emphasize stories that have pictures or videos, and you when you click on it, it shows it to you in a different format than sort of the web page than a web page would. It takes it and kind of rejiggers it into a kind of a magazine style. Let's see. Starting a few years ago, as an attempt to overhaul the news feed entirely, it's a project led by Vice President of Product Chris Cox, with involvement from Mark Zuckerberg. The ultimate aim of the app is to provide a paper-like format for news, combining together items from online publications with Facebook status updates, rather than providing a stream of consciousness already offered in the news feed. The first sightings of this possible news aggregating app surfaced in June 2013, though a later report claimed the app's existence. An earlier discovery in Facebook's Graph API saw listings for RSS feeds, update times, and subscriber details, but in a non-functional form. This was before Google shut down Reader, which caused a lot of users to flock to other services such as Dig and Feedly. Despite all the details in the report, it's still possible that Facebook will delay the launch of Paper beyond the end of January, although it sounds like it's close, and so it may not be very long, and Facebook would not comment on the rumor. Let's see. Then I did say you were going to get – excuse me. I did say you were going to get some Apple rumors. These are sort of – I don't know. They're kind of – I don't know. They're sort of meh. Research from Display Search has once again tapped its sources in the display supply chain to assess what panel sizes and resolutions are currently under development. And that's not for Apple in particular, but basically what's out there size-wise that's being built that could potentially land in the iPhone 6, a new iPad, and the rumored iWatch. You know, so basically they're looking at what the possible options are. According to the firm's latest report, the iPhone 6 and iPad may receive size and resolution boosts in line with rumors that have been around for a while the iWatch could sport a flexible AMOLED display. On the wearables, they think it could be a 1.3 to 1.6-inch screen with 320 by 320 resolution. That's funny. It's not even 640 by 480. You'd think they could get to there at least on your wrist, you know, so that you could have the equivalent of a 13-inch CRT on your wrist. But so it goes. High pixel per inch, 348 or 200 to between either 348 or 278, depending on the size. The 1.3-inch has higher resolution. And then they show some up to a 6.2-inch smartphone screen. But the suggestion from Display Search is that either a 4.7-inch 1600 by 900 screen or a 5.5-inch 1920 by 1080, 1080p, huh? Screen might be the future. On the high end, it's David Say, Display Search and analyst David Say, predicts the iPhone 6 could ship with the 5.5-inch display. Let's see, it's LTPS, low temperature polysilicon TFT LCD, in case that's stuff that is fascinating to you. On the iPad side of the equation, Apple may increase the size of the tablet and introduce a 12-inch iPad Pro model. That's rumors been around for a while. There have, however, been no parts leaks supporting the existence of such a device so far. According to Display Search, the iPad Pro could include a display with a resolution of 2732 by 2048. Wow. And 265 pixels per inch, which would edge out the 12.2-inch panel that Samsung introduced in its new Galaxy Tab Pro and Note Pro tablets. The Samsung models ship with a 12.2-inch display that's 2560 by 1600 and 247 pixels per inch. So we'll see. You know, obviously there's plenty more time for the rumors to develop and for this stuff to all be possibly announced. And finally, on new product stuff, this one's something that, you know, I've seen people mention why isn't this hasn't this happened sooner, or mention this thing as an option, that why hadn't it been added, and it looks like somebody is finally stepping up to do it. There is Lilliputing, which is, you know, small computing, spotted the HP Chromebook 11 on Best Buy's mobile site. The interesting thing with it is that it has that apparently for $100 more than the base one, it has LTE connectivity. And so you would have an always connected to the internet, even if you're not on Wi-Fi, Chromebook, if you were interested in such a thing. Let's see, the laptop may also be readily available after official launch. All the Best Buy, local Best Buy locations that the author of the article checked on GigaOm say the device is in stock. Altair, who basically – the reason this came out is they announced their chip would power the HP Chromebook 11 LTE model on Verizon's network. Altair says there's a $50 activation rebate, so your net cost could be $329 to get a Chromebook with LTE on it all the time. That's, you know, you start that price wise, depending, you know, with, I guess it's an 11-inch screen. Price wise, it's kind of that's fairly competitive with a lot of tablet devices out there. So it's kind of the, you know, is the Chromebook the new netbook, or is it like a mid device between tablets and laptops? I guess we'll find out. That's the news. I'm Peter Hughes with the Info Shot direct to your skull.
Right to your skull. All right. Well, I feel all neutral and stuff.
Fish for breakfast.
Groovehouse is locking the door, locking us in. He's sealing the chamber. He's spinning the locking dial.
I got used to doing that when Dwight was here, because he would make a big fuss about having the door open.
So. Would he?
And next week really. We will release the condiment gas.
Plus he watched the Andromeda Strain over the weekend. The old one. The old scary cool one. Not the
new horrible one.
New one.
All right, 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight. We are taking your calls. As I mentioned earlier, this is our pre-fundraising episode, our last just doing a show for doing a show's sake show. So I hope you participate. We hope you participate during the fundraiser next 2 weeks, but that'll be a different kind of thing. 713-526-KPFT. So it seems quieter lately. Just...
Did Dwight breathe that loud in the studio?
The vending machine does kick on and off every once in a while and kind of makes a humming, kind of gurgling kind of thing. Yeah.
No, it just seems like, you know, the whole thing is quieter. The phones are quieter, you know.
It's the post-holiday kind of blues.
Is that what it is?
Blues. Maybe everything's kind of tapering down, all the excitement, all the ever. Yeah, it's the first time everyone can kind of exhale and just be, maybe.
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 You know, been walking every afternoon with my wife, you know, going out and walking a couple of miles while the weather's good and monitoring to see who's taking down their Christmas decorations.
Are you part of the HOA? Are you HOA spy?
No. I don't have anything to complain about because, you know, I don't want anybody looking at us too closely either. But it's interesting to watch the kind of, you know, the people like we're the day, you know, New Year's Day is the day that we take all of our stuff down. That's our tradition. We pull all, you know, we have three trees we have to dismantle and all the decorations we pull off. But, you know, you walk around the neighborhood and people leave it up the first week of January. And some people, they take it down the second week of January.
Valentine's Day.
There's one house that took everything down except for one thing. And it's this ridiculous, like, stocking on a pole, Christmas stocking. Everything else is down. The house across the street has put up their Valentine's decorations. Just so you know, that's the neighborhood report. And back to you. 713-526-5738 if you want to give us an update or a status on your neighborhood Christmas decorations or something. 713-526-KPFT with your computer questions and so forth. La-di-da. So,
yeah, there aren't enough holidays where you really can decorate your house. You know, Valentine's Day is a pretty big stretch.
It is kind
Christmas
of a stretch.
Christmas and Halloween are kind of it.
St. Patrick's Day, although that could get...
Although there have been a lot of inflatable turkeys I've noticed lately around Thanksgiving. Inflatable lawn ornaments for Thanksgiving. Yeah.
Oh, lawn ornaments, okay. Sorry.
My question is,
I was thinking politics.
What other inflatables were you guys thinking?
Well, that's a different holiday altogether, isn't it now?
Hey-o.
All right, 713-526-KPFT. If you'd like to be on the air, we have all of our lines are open, and we have geeks standing by.
Are we fielding Windows 9 questions yet? Did you mention that in the news, Pete? I was listening to most of the news, but I looked at IRC once or twice.
No, Windows 9 didn't really get on my radar this news cycle.
They just made an announcement. That's all they really did. I was curious as to like how long Windows Vista was out there and how long Windows ME was out there before they announced the next version.
Vista was out for a while. Vista
was out, but ME was fairly... I mean, it only shipped. ME only shipped for like a year or so, right? On devices. I guess Google or Wikipedia would answer this.
Of Windows operating systems.
Well, what Vista went through, when XP was out, Vista went through like multiple code names before it actually got released. It started as like Longhorn and I think was something else. So it took there was a long cycle. They announced it really early. They talked about it, but then didn't produce or didn't
ship.
Yeah,
and that's all they're really doing with Windows 9. They're just talking about putting it out there, saying, hey, we want to move towards this, setting out the goals. They haven't really talked release dates or anything yet, I don't believe.
I think the reason there's not a lot of news about it is because before when they announced a new version of the operating system, people were interested and thought there might be that it would affect their decisions in their business or, with what they do with their computers. And I think that's kind of over. It's like stuff still works. If you stick, you got way too many people sticking with XP so far, and we're, two full operating systems and a major revision up from that.
So Windows 95, 1995 to 1998 for Windows 95. 1998 to 2000, we had 98, Windows 2000, Windows ME, and
So after 2000, they stopped putting the year in because they were doing so bad about getting
shipping actually. Yeah.
Windows ME was the last Microsoft operating system to be based on the Windows 95 code base. Microsoft announced that all future operating systems would be based on the NT. And that was Windows, ME and Windows 2000 Professional. I remember having a lot of Windows 2000 Professional computers still running when I took this job that I'm at now. 2001 to 2005, Windows XP, XP Professional. And 2006 to 2008 was Vista. And 2009 to 2011 was Windows 7. With Windows Touch, and then 2012 to 2013, we have Windows 8.
Yes, we're a solid 8 years behind XP being replaced, and it's still predominant OS, it seems like.
Yeah.
Aside from, the cutting-edge OSs out there.
Indeed.
And imagine, Apple's been doing, 10-point-this, 10-point-that, and they're up to, 10.9 now. If they had just gone up numerically, the difference between them and Windows would be kind of radical right now. You'd be on Apple OS, 19? Compared to, Windows releasing how many over the past couple decades?
Yeah. 713.
The other side is Apple took a different approach. They're not doing the kind of big, massive, total reworks that that Windows seems to still be trying to do.
Well, the trouble that Windows, I think, has is, you know, they have to evolve their operating system to run on so many different hardware combinations. You know, the closed architecture of the Apple systems, you know, you can build an upgraded operating system and it works with, you know, all the existing hardware. At least you can kind of plan for, you've got this many Apple computers out there. This is the hardware combination. Will the software run on that? Yes or no. But with Windows, you know, you're trying to build it for, you know, every couple of months, a new video card comes out, a new sound card chipset comes out. So it's harder, I think. You know, I'm not trying to defend Microsoft or anything, but it's harder for them. We should give them a break.
It's kind of weird. I used to be a big Microsoft, not a Microsoft hater, but, you know, very pro-Linux. And whenever Microsoft would, you know, raise its stick and go after Linux, I'd be upset. But now I want to see Microsoft do well, or at least do better. I don't want them to go away. I don't know if that's nostalgia or if that's just like old fanboyism that's been repressed for so long it's just not coming out, or what it is, but I want to see them do well. I don't want them to go away. I don't want them to falter. Well, like it seems like they're with Windows 8.
I would guess they're going to do kind of like IBM did, which is where they're going to fade to where they're there, and at every major, you know, corporation they have plenty of presence, but they're not really big in people's just general consumer lives.
Well, this whole bring-your-own-device thing is starting to take over in the corporate world right now. So you have people that are showing, you know, like in my office and in corporate offices all over, you have people showing up to the office with their own tablets, with their iPads and their Android tablets and their smartphones and so forth. So, you know, it's less and less becoming about the PC.
And they still use – Office has still got a pretty strong support, and I would think at most businesses that people have desktops or computers issued by the company that they're still going to have a Microsoft operating system on them for at least the near future.
Well, we have a – yeah, they'll still have a Microsoft – at least the Microsoft Office, because you can get that for the Mac now. We've got a lot of people that are starting to come out and get, you know, Mac laptops instead of Windows laptops, and they're running the Mac OS, and they're running Office for the Mac and doing fine.
Although as paper becomes less and less important, Office is kind of bloated. I mean, it does a lot of stuff that I don't know how useful it is long term if you're not printing it out and handing it to somebody anymore.
Right. Well, that, I mean, they're still printing. I still have my fair share of printer problems at the office. People are still printing.
The J. Lee Full Employment for Printer Maintenance Act is still in effect.
My cat picture won't print. Help.
My animated GIF is not
My GIF comes out all pixelated when I print it.
Well, we lost that one phone call. I'm sorry about that. We were going to take your call about upgrading to XP, or from XP, I mean. 713-526-5738 if you want to try again, or if someone else wants to call. We have all the lines are open. We were having a little conversation to make sure that we just didn't have a, well, when's the next call coming? When's the next call coming? Be the only thing we were talking about. So if you call in, you know, we'll get to your call here as quick as we can. Please don't be afraid. 713-526-KPFT.
And for our listeners who may not know what we do or who may just be tuning in, what kind of calls do we take?
Well, we take all kinds of calls. We take
cat calls.
Normal calls, crazy calls.
Prank calls.
Easy, guys. I take those calls.
No, we thought those were wolf whistles.
You know, this is a computer phone-in show. That's, I mean, right. we've been on for, you know, 18 years, coming up on 18 years. We talk about technology. If we're here to help you out, if you've got a question about how to do something with your computer, if you've got a question on how to fix something or anything like that, that's what we're here for, and we're happy to take those calls. 713-526-5738. There's a phone line ringing.
We are coming up on 19 years, actually.
Is it 19? Would we get legal? Yeah.
Wow.
That is.
We can go to war and vote.
Is when we started, May of 1995. Late May 1995, so net 2015, that's the 20th anniversary of the show.
That might be our last show, too. 713-526-5738. If you want to be on there, see another call coming in, give us a second. We'll get you in the queue as well. Groovehouse is doing his job screening what's coming in so that we can get it ready for to be on the air. Windows 9 will introduce not only new features, but also simpler Windows lineup. As mentioned, Windows 9 is expected to restore the start menu, which everybody went, hooray! We love the start menu. And does 9 Isolator also likely introduce more unified code base among Microsoft's various Windows platforms? Has yet to officially acknowledge Windows 9, but is expected to do so in April. Although this article was written, and it wasn't that long ago. All right, Groove House.
Yes.
I see that we have a call in the queue.
We have a call in the queue, and we have a couple on hold, and we're going to get right back to those. But first up on the show, we're going to speak with George.
George, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Doing good, and I'm so happy. Y'all just don't know. Whatever y'all did, if y'all boosted up your power or what, because that Hispanic station that used to bleed you guys out is gone, I hope, for a while. I'm up here in Huntsville.
Oh, okay. Well, good. We're kind of trying to keep them out of the way so that we can get out to Huntsville. Yeah, it looks like...
Appreciate it. Quick question, and it's kind of an ignorant one, but I just wanted to find out before I get ready to purchase a new phone. What's the difference between a smartphone and an Android phone?
Android phone is typically a smartphone.
Okay.
So your smartphone...
I noticed that a friend of mine, he has an Android, and he has a whole bunch of... He can, access a whole bunch of apps, because I usually get the unlimited on everything, from the data to talk and text. And he just got access to a lot of things. This phone I have now, I think it's probably a 2G phone, because what happens toward the end of my service date, I get limited on my data. It'll hold my, if I'm going online, getting my browser up, it takes forever for it to even bring up a website or any of that type of stuff. And then it's just little small things, even my ringers, my alerts, like for my text messages or email, I have to actually constantly check my phone, because 6 or 7 days before that in-service end date comes up, it stops alerting me to my calls, with the exception of just the normal phone call.
Well, I mean, if it's how long have you had the phone?
Oh, let's try about 4. Well, this is going into the 5th year now.
Well, I mean, what provider are you using?
From Wally World. Walmart, Straight Talk.
Okay, so yeah, you probably have a not a fully feature-rich phone, and probably have a limited data plan.
On the plus side, whatever you get as far as Android smartphone.
Hold on, y'all are talking over each other. Let Pete say something here real quick, caller.
Okay.
On the plus side, whatever you get, even another prepaid plan phone, which obviously they don't tend to put the latest and greatest on those, is going to be a dramatic performance increase and have a lot more capabilities than what you've got now.
Okay, yeah, that's what my friend was telling me. He said, man, you gotta, he said, when I was dealing with cassettes, they were already with the disc, and when I finally got the disc, now they got MP3 and all other type of disc. I'm just always behind on everything.
Well, if you get something a little bit more up to date and go with a standard carrier like AT&T or Verizon or something like, or even T-Mobile, and get one of the high-speed plans. I don't know if it's in your budget or not, but if you're using your phone, a smartphone is a phone that has apps and allows you to get access to the internet, access your email, use maps and GPS and so forth. You have to pay a little bit more to have a phone that does that well, but
I bought one. They got one that's running right about 80 bucks, and the thing about I'm really looking at it is because it actually has a lot of those features and offers a lot of those features, and it still comes in my budget because I'm paying $50 for unlimited talk, text, and data right now.
Right. Well, if you got pre-3G, if you've got a phone that's not even 3G, then your internet experience is going to be very poor. So if you get a new phone, you get a new plan that's 3G, you could probably get it in that same price range. You'll probably enjoy it quite a bit.
Okay, yeah, because that was what I was wondering about. Because, like I said before, up until toward the end of last year, and I'll let you guys go, I was able to get videos and all that. Now, it'll tell me that this system or something to that effect does not support that type of function. Well, I know it must be getting pretty old now.
You know, like people sending you, emailing you stuff, or like trying to watch YouTube and trying to watch videos off the net.
Right, right.
Second part. Probably they've updated codecs, and you've got different ways the video plays are doing things, and your feature phone just isn't updating. Whereas if you get an Android phone, all those apps generally stay up to date. So, Jay said, it'll be night and day.
When I first got the phone, about once a month, they would actually tell me, they would text me a message, tell me to cut the phone off so they could update or do something to that effect. It was going fine up until, like I said, right toward the end of last year. And then all of a sudden now it's like it won't receive, I don't get none of those kind of messages.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you on that. I mean, if you're going to upgrade, if you're looking to get a new phone, I just say go that plan, you know, go that route. If you're interested in getting that phone to work again or get it to work properly, you may be looking at a reset, you know.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't know. The phone's 4 years old. If you've been using it, and does it allow you to install apps on it?
Yes, but they got some type of plan. It's a new plan that,
I can't tell you much about your phone because you're not telling me much about your phone. But I'll tell you what, I'm going to let you go since I think you're going to go ahead and go with getting a new phone. I think that's probably going to be your best option. And look at getting a better plan. Make sure it's 3G or 4G if you want to have a decent internet experience on your phone.
Sounds good, guys. And again, I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. That's all right. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT, if you want to be on the air with Technology Bites. We've got open lines. We've got two calls in the queue here as we approach the top of the hour. We can probably deal with these calls and maybe a couple more before we have to take a short break for station business. Groovehouse. I said Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who's up?
Up next on the show, we are going to speak with Eric.
Eric, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi, Jay. Everyone else.
Hey, Eric.
In listening to what you were talking about earlier about, I guess, the use of desktops and Microsoft, too many people seem to forget that it's not all just spreadsheets and Word or whatever, you know, documentation. Because the work I do is drafting, and then I also know people do GIS. And you got to have a desktop for that. And almost every one of them use Microsoft. And then it's dual monitor stuff. And, you know, when Microsoft OS 8 came out, it's like, did they even look at their own people, what they had to do, especially for coding? Were they coding on a tablet?
Well, I mean, the new operating system is perfectly suitable on a desktop.
Yeah, if you go through a lot of, you know, hoops and rigmarole and whatever else.
Why do you say that? Why do you say hoops and rigmarole? What kind of hoops? I mean, I've loaded Windows 8 on a computer, and it really runs just about like any other Windows operating system.
If you get rid of that stupid Metro thing, I guess. I've never seen it.
Have you used a Windows 8 computer?
No, I have not.
All right. I will say that I had my reservations about Windows 8.
Me too.
And but when I got down and sat in front of one and realized that tile menu was nothing more than the start menu exploded in front of you, so that instead of clicking on start and bringing up a list of applications, you just had a list of applications sitting in front of you. Click on the application and you go.
It works. I like the idea of the desktop.
Well, it's still there.
It's still there.
I open mine and boom, straight to the desktop every time.
Yeah, you could tell Windows 8 to go, and it's not a lot of hoops or rigmarole. It's pretty straightforward, but you can have it go straight to the desktop, or there's an icon right there. You click it, takes you to the desktop. So I don't know that, you know, Windows 8 is all that bad. I think a lot of people that are judging it, and myself included, did so based on what they hear kind of in the media or hear in the public stream, but haven't sat down with it. And it really is. It's just so much like Windows. It's not even funny.
Yeah.
The thing that I've seen, now, when you mentioned that you use drafting or CAD programs, one of the things that is legitimate, I think, is with any new OS, is that some of these more fine-tuned programs like AutoCAD and so forth that people write for doing a specific job, sometimes the older version, you know, some of that software is very expensive, and you might have a version that's, you know, a couple of versions out of date, but runs really great on an XP machine, but you try to load it on a Windows 7 or a Windows 8 computer, and it doesn't work, because the software is no longer compatible. So the thought of having to upgrade these expensive programs to run in new operating systems, that's a legitimate concern.
Yeah, AutoCAD itself costs something like $6,000 or $8,000 per license.
But don't be
GIS costs $10,000 per license.
Right. Mm-hmm. Don't be under the illusion that Windows 8 is only for mobile devices. One of the things that Microsoft's trying to do, and I applaud them for this, although it's kind of late, you know, Apple did it so well, is they're trying to make it more fluid between a desktop, a laptop, and a mobile device, kind of having that same experience on all the devices and all of your data available on all devices. That's something that's very, very compelling and a very good, justification for what they're trying to do with the way that the operating system, the look and feel of it. But underneath,
I don't think that Apple really did that with the interface, though. Like the Apple desktop is different than the iPad or the iPhone interface.
I agree.
Now, those two are the same. iPhone, iPad are the same, but the Apple desktop experience is different. And I've used a Windows 8 machine a little bit. I still find it somewhat frustrating because it feels like I'm interfacing with what should be a tablet. Like, it should be a touch device just because the tiles are big. I mean, I have this huge screen, and I've got these big tiles, and you have to go into a corner to bring up a hidden pop-up menu to get to the options, and it just, to me, it doesn't feel the same as a desktop.
No, they're trying to be both. It's right. Kind of like if Apple had made their desktop be more like an iPad, where you had large, and they did. They actually, that has come up in the new Apple operating systems, because you have the launch pad.
They've done it. Yeah, they've done it a little bit, but the launch pad doesn't launch by default, and you have to interface with the launch pad or figure out how to get out of it.
Like, right.
It's there if you want to use it, but the interface that pops up by default is a complex desktop interface with a lot of options on it. To me, it just feels different.
Well, basically what I was saying is, even though Microsoft upsets me sometimes just in general everyday use, I don't think that they're going to go away.
No, I don't think they're going to go away either. And I agree that we have a lot of applications, a lot of things that run that have to run on a Windows computer. It has to be Microsoft, or else there's just not an option to run it. But that's changing as things become more web-based. I mean, if you have an application that is a web-based application, a lot of the stuff that we're doing now, that we're using now, is web-based. Of course, there's probably not a web-based AutoCAD yet, but who knows? It might be coming.
It'll require Silverlight.
Well,
I know Andrew is working to that end for GIS.
Yeah. Well,
with AutoCAD, the biggest thing I think that you're going to see changing in the next couple of years is, as 4K monitors become mainstream, the two monitors for your AutoCAD is going to turn into just one big 4K monitor.
Yeah, if you can stretch it out. I don't know what a 4K monitor is. I don't keep up on the tech as much as y'all do. But
well, the 4K monitor basically is like a high-def monitor, except it's twice as tall, and it's twice as many pixels high and twice as many pixels wide. So it's really got four times the screen of most mainstream monitors right now.
Well, that's okay. I mean, the thing with I've seen GIS monitors that look like that, and usually the only people standing in front of them are geologists, not people sitting at their desk. Where you got to crane your neck to look up the top of the screen. It's like it's
best. Oh no, they're not giant. They're the size of they're slightly larger than the current monitors, but they're made. There actually are programmers now who are going out and getting 4K televisions, cheap ones, and hooking them up to use. They're kind of early adopters, but it's coming to the desktop.
That's actually going around a lot. Someone wrote an article a couple of weeks ago about doing that, and actually linked to the model of monitor that's like, you know, $500 on Amazon. And yeah, so all these developers are doing it. Instead of having a double-headed monitor, they can have their code window, they can have debugger, they can have the web browser, they can have like the equivalent of four monitors up. But you can actually read it because it's like you're looking at something real.
Pixel density.
Yeah, yeah. It's like
you're supposed to go OLED. The downside is that it's a 30 megahertz refresh.
I guess you need to see an AutoCAD office sometime.
What's that?
I guess what you need to do is see AutoCAD in operation, because when we do it, it's two monitors, two widescreen monitors, and, you know, either to have two sessions of AutoCAD open at once, or have all your fly-out menus on the other screen.
No, I agree. I think it's two different things. I'm not completely sold on the idea that one 4K monitor is going to replace a dual screen setup. I could see a setup that might have two 4K monitors mm-hmm. or two high resolution monitors, but there's a reason to have two monitors and kind of have stuff slid off onto one and have your workspace on the other. And there might be a cause to have a giant monitor. Like when I'm using my iMac, for example, I've got a 27-inch iMac, and I have to kind of get the idea that I don't have to have my browser expanded to the full screen size. Mm-hmm. You can have the browser over on the right-hand side. I can have a different application running over on the left-hand side. So I've got a lot more desktop real estate, and I'm not craning my neck to look to the left at another monitor. So there's that's just a matter of preference. Listen, we're running out of time in this first hour, so but thanks for your call, Eric.
Okay.
All right, bye.
I pretty much never maximize a window, almost ever, although I still use dual screens. But even on the screens, I don't have any window maximized pretty much ever.
Data files, we will. But we're dealing with, like, fixed width files that are, like, 1,200 characters across, and it's nice to see.
Well, Apple really discourages you from maximizing your screen in that way. Because
it's kind of hard to make it zoom. Like, there's no built-in button just to make it take up the
entire
screen.
It's not like on a Windows computer where you click the maximize button, and it goes and takes up the whole screen. You click the maximize button, and it takes up the amount of screen that it thinks it needs to use.
Oh, no, but in the new version of the Apple OS, you can. It's, again, they're trying to recreate the iPad, iPhone thing, so you can actually make it full screen, where it actually takes over everything, and you can't see anything.
Command
F11. And you're like, how do I get out of this? Now I'm stuck.
I love that when I'm doing stuff, when I'm sending stuff to the Apple TV over AirPlay and doing the full screen in that way. It kind of looks cool. You just have to remember that you can push your mouse up to the top and get
I'm
to the
stuck.
Other side. Yeah. All right, well, we got two calls in the queue, but we are running out of time in the first hour of the show, so we hope that you'll keep hanging on, and we will we'll get to your calls after the top of the hour. But if you also want to, if you're listening in right now and you want to get in the queue for the second hour of the show, the phone number is 713-526-5738 or 713-526-KPFT. That music tells me that it is. We're in that grace period where we can kind of relax and let go and space out.
Breathe in through your mouth and out through your nose.
Welcome to the Technology Bites yoga program.
The moment of Zen.
Sit and be fit.
Sit and be fat, like the rest of us. Like
all right.
Me.
Well, you're listening to Technology Bites. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back after these messages. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse. Namaste.
You can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Imagine hearing KPFT even when a thunderstorm has knocked out power to our transmitter. Imagine listening to your favorite KPFT programs when you're out of town. You can. You can listen online with your computer, go to kpft.org, then click on one of the Listen Live links at the very top of our homepage. We have medium and high fidelity links there for both our regular analog channel and our HD2 channel. See the links at the top of kpft.org. There's more. Imagine being able to hear any KPFT program at any time that fits your schedule. Go to archive.kpft.org and listen or download any show from the last 2 weeks. For information on subscribing to your favorite show to download it automatically to your computer, click on the podcast help link at archive.kpft.org. This is KPFT Houston.
And we're back.
Imagine there's no computer problems. All right. So 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with Technology Bites. We've got calls in the queue. Who do we have up next, Groovehouse?
All right. Up next on the second half of the show, we're going to start it off with Ferris.
Ferris, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, guys. My question to you is very simple. I assume all of you is from Houston, is that right?
Yeah, Pete's in San Antonio, but yes, we're okay. Mostly Houston.
I've been kind of struggling with internet services. I'm wondering which one is fast. You know, I switched from cable to fiber optic right now with Verizon, and they'll tell me it's 25 download speed, and when I did the testing, it didn't come to half what they're assuming it is, and sometimes I feel it's not as fast as I want it to be. And they want me to pay $10 more to double the speed. I'm not sure if they're slowing it down on purpose, but what's your intake on that?
So what speed are you actually getting when you do a speed test? Like you're getting 12 and a half?
Well, you know, one time I was just checking other internet providers, and actually when I did the testing, it was on Verizon website itself. So. And it didn't come up to what the speed I supposed to have.
So you have Verizon at home?
It's Verizon.
It's fiber optic. Fios, right?
I'm sorry?
Is it Fios?
No. It's just the internet. I don't have their TV service.
Okay.
So Verizon's a reseller for Xfinity and Comcast, aren't they? How do they deliver the internet signal to your house? Is it via a cable?
No.
Or is it wireless?
It's fiber optic.
They
came and installed that box outside my house.
Uh huh.
And I have the line from that. That box is only for me, not for the entire neighborhood.
Technically, even though you don't have TV, I think they still refer to that as Fios, like FIOS.
So, okay, so, and they're saying, what is the speed that they're telling you should have?
25
megabits. So if you go to speedtest.net and you do a test on that, what is your actual download speed?
Oh, I didn't go to that website you just mentioned.
How are you judging your speed?
Well, when I go online, it's not as good. Actually, I was very impressed when I started the service, but now it's not as fast.
Well, the thing is that you have to diagnose the issue to determine whether it's a problem with the service or if it's a problem with how you're connecting to the service. Because if your computer is not performing properly, it could have some serious problems on the internet that could be a result of spyware.
Yeah, I have a brand new iMac, and it's just, I mean, compared.
How does it connect to your internet service?
It's wired. It's Ethernet cable.
Okay, so an Ethernet cable going to your router or whatever.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're experiencing what you believe to be poor performance on the internet.
I don't want to say it's poor, but it's not as fast as you would think. It's like fiber optic would give you.
Well, it's possible. It's possible that you're getting poor service from your internet connection, but you want to have something to go on to determine if it's an issue with the service, or if it's an issue with the computer, or if it's an issue with the router, or an issue with the cable. But it'd be nice to know what your actual benchmark
is.
Well,
I have to put it out in a different way. My question is, like, going by the book or theoretically, would cable provider give you as much speed as fiber optic?
No. So I've got Comcast. About the fastest you can go with them right now is 100 megabits per second.
Okay. Which is very fast.
Which is very, very fast. But looking at the Verizon.com site and seeing what you can go with Fios, you can go up to, so you've probably got the 50-25 service. You can get 75 down. You can get 150 down. You can get 300 down. Or if you're really up there, you can get 500 megabits per second down, which is five times faster than anything Comcast has to offer.
But you have to pay for it.
You
got to
pay for it, yeah.
Right. So the basic cable internet access is, I think, around 25 megabits or less. I haven't priced them in a while.
Yeah, mine is I'm paying $65 a month. Does that sound reasonable?
$65 for the 25 service?
Yes.
Yeah.
They said if you add $10 more, you will get the 50.
The 50.
Right, and that Comcast offers or Xfinity offers something similar, where they have their basic service. Their basic service right now that they're talking about is their internet up to 50 megabits per second, $50 a month for the first 12 months on an introductory offer that they have going right
but
now.
You have to buy their TV.
No, you don't.
Pure internet. That's internet only.
Pure internet, and it's not on a contract.
Okay, but you're saying but the speed they sell you, is it the actual speed you were getting? What I read about it, that they said the fiber optic is a single line going to your house, and if you're connecting during a busy time, other people being on the net, or it's not going to slow you down while.
That used to be the case a little bit with cable modems because of the way that they used to provision it. That's not so much the case anymore. Really, the only way that fiber optic is going to be there are two ways that fiber optic is going to be faster than cable. The first way is that if you're willing to pay for it, the sheer bandwidth, they can offer more through fiber optic than they can on cable. And then everything else, let's say you're getting the same speed tests on both. If you're pinging a server or if you're doing anything where the speed of your packets, the return trip, fiber is going to be a lot faster. So if you're doing gaming or if you're doing like, you know, real-time video or like you're Skyping and stuff, fiber will win out ahead on that as well. But that's really the main difference.
One of the things you want to do is you want to go and see what your actual download speeds are.
Okay. So would you mention that website one more time?
Speedtest.net.
Okay.
And so do some tests to see what your actual throughput is. If you're paying for, say, let's just say you're paying for 25 megabit internet access and you are only averaging 10 to 12, then you probably have a problem somewhere, either with the service as it's being delivered to your residence or with the equipment that you're connecting to in the house. And it could be that you have a bad, you know, it could be something you, trying to diagnose a network problem requires that you take a look at every possible point of failure. So I know, for example, with a cable modem, you know, the thing that you want to do in your home network to verify that the cable modem's getting the speed that you're supposed to is you connect your computer directly to the modem and test your internet that way. And if it works fine, but then you connect to your router, and it slows down, then it could indicate that you have an issue with your router. I've had routers go bad on me. I've had cables go bad on me, you know, Ethernet cables go bad on me. I've had poor wireless reception for wireless devices. So there's any number of things that could go wrong. But if you can show or demonstrate that you're not getting the speed that you're supposed to get, then you can have a technician come out from Verizon and address that situation.
Now, what's the accept? Like, let's say if they told you we're telling you 25 and you're getting 20 when you test it, is that something acceptable? You don't have to complain.
I'd say that's acceptable. And what you need to do is you need to look in the end user license agreement or whatever the terms of service that came with that, and usually it says we don't guarantee anything, and the advertised things are just maybe what you can expect under optimal conditions.
Right.
Chances are they don't guarantee anything.
But if like for at my house with my cable internet access, I was promised a certain speed, and I was having enough problems on it that they had to send a couple of techs out and rewire my house.
But you got it fixed, though, right?
I got it fixed, and now it's blazing fast. But I was having a lot of connectivity problems, and they actually had to come out and run tests on the line as it came into the house. They had to run tests on the line in the house. and they were able to isolate the problem and rewired what needed to be rewired, and now it's working properly, and I'm getting, you know, they say up to 50 megabits. So I average about any, sometimes I get 45, sometimes I get 75. So
But, when you said they rewired your house, they have to go through the walls?
No, they had to rewire from their box to where it joined to my house. All my household wiring was fine. If it had been, but so they had to rewire the cable that came from their box in the neighborhood to my house.
Oh, I see.
But they didn't catch that the first three times I had them come out and look at the problem. But they finally, I was adamant enough and was able to demonstrate that there was a problem, and they sent out some of their top technicians, and they came out and they started running tests on all the lines, and they found the problem and they solved it. So it may be that Verizon has a problem with the equipment that they have connected to your house. But again, it would really help to know what your actual speeds were. What you think or what you feel about it doesn't really carry any water, and it may be completely valid that you're not having a very good internet experience or getting what you're promised from your provider, but you need to be able to speak to that with actual figures. So speedtest.net is a good starting point for getting some benchmarks on what kind of download speed you should expect. If you are going, for example, I've talked to people, I've done internet support, for 20 years, I've done a lot of different things with networks and internet. And sometimes the expectation of the user is not completely valid, because they might be going to websites that are, the website itself is slow. I know a lot of people go chasing after videos and downloads and stuff, and especially like these sites that offer free downloads for movies and songs and so forth. Those don't tend to be very good sites to go to in the first place, but they also tend to have, they don't have a very big pipe to the internet. So you would experience very poor internet performance. So you want to be testing against, things like YouTube and other legitimate sites to see what your internet experience is really like. And then use a benchmark like Speedtest to get a real feel for what you're actually getting download wise.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
All right, 713-526-5738. 713-526-KPFT is the number to call if you want to be on the air with us tonight. Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who do we have up next?
Up next, we are going to speak with Don.
Don, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Good evening, Bite Gurus.
Good evening, Bite-E.
Well, here's a question you've had before, and I've listened to people with the same kind of problem, but... And I've done this before, guys, but it's always a pain in the backside. It's transferring data, migrating data from one PC, one laptop to another using good old Windows Easy Transfer. Well, I got a brand new Toshiba here sitting in front of me with Windows 8.1 on it, and I'm trying to come out of another laptop with Vista on it, and I read all about it. I did my homework. I went on and I read about it, and there shouldn't be any problem doing this. I have a transfer cable, which I used many moons ago, 4 or 5 years ago, and had no problems using a Belkin transfer cable. I've got that cable in front of me, and I used it. I downloaded the latest versions of the Easy Transfer into both machines, the older machine, the Vista machine. The closest thing I could find that was compatible was the Easy Transfer Windows Vista /7, I think it was, for, and it's, of course, a 32-bit machine. My new machine's a 64-bit machine. But anyway, I've gone through this drill, and I've got it in front of me right now. I've got the cable looking at both of these machines, and the old computer, the one the data's coming off of, is still trying to find a cable, and it's not recognizing that it's recognizing the other computer. It won't recognize the other computer from the cable. The interesting thing, guy, before I stop with what I'm saying as far as the problem here, is that on the new machine here with Windows Easy Transfer on it, I'm looking at it, and the window that's up right now for Windows Easy Transfer says, ask me a question. It's the first thing on its panel that comes up. It says, have you saved your files to an external drive or USB flash drive? And then it says connect it to this machine now. It doesn't even look like on my new machine, the Windows Easy Transfer on that, it doesn't even look like it's it even asks you about a cable or networking transfer. It wants to see a flash drive or a hard drive.
Or it's or it automatically detects if there is a – the fact that it's not seeing the other computer
– on the cable.
Might be telling it to ignore that as an option.
Okay, yeah, in other words, it's not recognizing the cable either on the new machine, so it's not giving you the option.
Right, so I've not used Easy Transfer before, but my guess is that when you fire that program up, it's looking to say, okay, I see this other computer on the network, or I see, an external drive or something like mm-hmm. that. It knows you want to transfer files, but it doesn't see any place to transfer them
And even
from.
Though I've got that cable plugged into it from the other machine, it still doesn't see it.
What kind of cable is it? Is it USB?
Yeah, it's a USB plug. It's the Easy Transfer cables that have been available for years and years, Jay, and it's an older one, but I called Belkin and asked him, is this a cable usable on a new Windows 8.1 system? He said, yeah, it's a cable. These transfer cables are pretty universal, you know.
Do you have to install any kind of drivers for it? I've never used one of those. I'm trying to figure out if it's just a USB transfer cable or if it's like it's got its own.
The Easy Transfer download that you most computers come with it now, and if it's going Windows, it's got Easy Transfer on them, okay?
Right.
But my older computer, I wanted to make sure, because it's 4 years old, I want to make sure it had the latest and greatest. So I went to Windows and downloaded the Easy Transfer for it. But no, everything's built into those Easy Transfer softwares. You know, you don't have to download drivers and stuff like that. Everything's there.
I was just curious. They're selling Easy Transfer cables for Windows 8 specifically, and so I'm just wondering if that's marketing or if they really want you to get that one for Windows 8.
I think
where the issues are cropping up.
When you transfer the data down line through a cable, USB cable. Wait, so, you know, I say it's a USB connection, but you guys realize there's a electronic knot in the middle of this cable.
So it's USB.
Now,
it's,
I'm looking online. It says, although Microsoft has removed support in Windows 8.1 for upgrading to a new computer using Windows Transfer cable with the Windows Easy Transfer software, that software still offers the easiest and most automated method, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, right, right, yeah.
Microsoft Windows Easy Transfer is built into Windows 7 and Windows 8 and is available as a free download when using Windows XP. Let's see. You can migrate in the following scenarios. From Windows XP SP2 or higher to a Windows Vista PC to a Windows 7 or Windows 8 PC.
Mm-hmm.
What it says
I'm going from Vista to Windows 8.1, so...
It does not look like... Let's see. Please note that the Windows Easy Transfer software does not support using the Windows Transfer cable in Windows 8.1 or upgrading from 64-bit version of Windows to a 32-bit version of Windows. So it's saying that 8.1 is not supported for this.
So my new machine with 8.1 on it won't recognize a cable being plugged
in. That's what it's looking like, according to what I'm reading.
Okay, guys, what do I have to do to migrate data from my old machine to my
I'm going to tell you, I've set people up with new computers all the time, and I've got it down to a bit of a science. There's really the only things that you want from your old computer, really. I mean, you may say differently, but I'll tell you what you want. What you want are all of your documents and your images.
Yep.
And what you probably also want are your email archives.
Music, maybe.
And your music. And you want your Internet Explorer favorites.
Yeah, and that's the only thing that Easy Transfer historically, which you can't transfer programs. They have to be.
Right. So what I do, what I typically do is when I get a new computer set up and running the way that I like it, I'll take the you can either copy the files onto an external hard drive, or you can just take the hard drive out of the old computer and connect it to a cable to the USB on the new computer.
Okay. Well, I got that cable, Jay. As a matter of fact, what I do, and typically I've told you this before when I've talked to you, I always, when I get a new machine, and this new one here, I'm going to get a new drive for it, and I'm going to clone with Acronis home image. I clone the drive.
Okay.
Now, I do have a cloned drive from the old machine sitting here that I cloned a week ago.
Okay.
So you're telling me I can
take that drive.
I got a cable that goes to a USB for
all
that
right,
drive.
Plug it into your new computer.
Yeah.
And so that your new computer sees that drive as a second drive or an external drive.
Okay.
Under your user profile on the old drive, it'll be whatever the drive letter is, /user/ whatever your username is. There, all your folders that you want are right there. You got your favorites folder.
Yeah, everything's there.
Your documents folder.
Right, it's a cloned drive.
Right.
That on there.
So you take those, take all of those files, all those folders, and you move them over to the new computer under your user profile on the new computer. So C:\user/whatever your username is, you'll see your My Documents folder, your Favorites folder. You take all of those folders from there, not the app data folder or anything, just the Documents folder, the Desktop folder, and the Favorites folder, and you pull those over and you put them on the new computer. You'll have all of your documents, all
of
your...
Can that pretty much be dragged across from one?
Yes, it can.
Okay. See, I don't hope I don't get confused with that part. I got you all the way up to hooking up that drive to USB and then opening that drive up on my new machine to look at what's in there.
Well, what I typically like to do is I create a folder on the desktop of my new computer.
Okay.
And I grab those folders, lock, stock, and barrel, and I drag them and drop them into that folder on the desktop of the new computer.
Now I can do that.
And then I just go through that, and I say, okay, here's all of my documents. I'm going to grab those and throw them into My Documents under my user. You know, I just look at the My Documents folder and drag them into there.
Okay.
And they'll go, bloop, they go right over. And then get your Favorites, bloop, they go right over.
Okay.
That's super easy.
That was one of the questions I had written down.
Also, might work is, no, it won't, because the easy transfer cable may not work with Windows 8.1, but it might work with that drive as an external drive.
I got you.
Remember earlier in the call you said that it was asking if you had an external drive, plug it in now.
Right. The new machine.
Yeah.
Easy transfer on the new machine.
Yeah, so,
but it's much easier just to do what you said, because I got a...
Well, it might even be easier to do the easy transfer now that if it will see the external drive.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I have to plug.
Either way.
Yeah.
You've got options.
Right. Right. Well, I'll try that, and you know, I'm not the best at software myself, but I'll give it a try. But yeah, I had that clone drive sitting here from my old machine, which I made a week ago, and it's... But it, you know, in the new machine won't be, because that clone drive, Jay, has the old operating system Vista on it. That didn't confuse the new machine. I mean,
it doesn't care.
Doesn't care, because all I'm pulling is files.
All you're doing is pulling the files off.
I got you. Okay, guys. Well, I hope that's straightened my brain out on this thing, but I'll sure give that a try. And if next week, if I have any problems, I'll give you a call.
Well, the good thing is that you're not going to lose any data because it's on the clone drive and it's on the old computer. You're not doing anything destructive to that.
I'm not going to destroy that or anything.
So, yeah, so you got some leverage. You got some
safety built
into
it. Yeah. Okay, guys. Man, I appreciate it.
All right, good luck. Thanks for your call. All right, bye.
Are those programs still really necessary? I know, you know, back in the day when it was hard to network two computers together with Windows 3.1, having like easy transfer programs and having things that you know, plug proprietary cable and you click something and it just makes copies. That was a value. But these days, I mean, isn't your method...
Now you have to open up the computer and install a serial card in one of the PCI ports so that you can use the transfer cable.
Well, you know, if in the course of owning a computer, you figured out anything about the file structure, then yes, it's super easy to do that. But most people still don't, you know, it's not uncommon for people to not know the underlying file structure or where things are stored. I've had people that were in, you know, my boss tell me that you need to copy certain things over. And I was like, no, you don't. You don't have to copy over app data folders. You don't have to copy over OST files and so forth.
Migrate the DLLs.
Windows has finally gotten better about that. I mean, it's been a number of years, but 8-10 years ago, there were a lot of problems where, you know, you went to change computers, a Windows machine, and yeah, it was like, oh yeah, get this. Oh, and yeah, you need your address book file out of this other location, and your mail folders out of this other location, and then
getting your mail archives can kind of be a pain. If you're using something like Windows Live Mail or something, like if you're using Outlook, it's a simple matter of grabbing your PST and pulling it over and then knowing how to open it up again.
But the thing is, nowadays they've kind of gone more towards what Unix has always done, which is where a user's data is all located in the user's home folder.
Right.
It's not spread out over the system.
Right.
Because Unix started as a true multi-user environment, so you didn't really have that where the original... Microsoft
you still don't
want
to grab the
like
entire
all over the place.
You still don't want the entire user folder because it's still the user folder has application specific data in certain folders that if you don't have that application installed on the new computer, or if you do and you drag that stuff over, it could cause things to break. But as far as just get all your My Documents folder has all your videos, all your images, if you've used that properly. So you copy that over, it's fine. You get a Favorites folder, which has all your bookmarks for Internet Explorer, so you copy that over. You have a Desktop folder, which has all the stuff that you've dumped on your desktop. So you move that over, and it's all there. But some people, I think, too, the problem is that they do want to transfer their applications. They think they're going to move the application over. And you don't want to do that, even if you give an, even if you're given a tool that supposedly will let you do it. You're better off reinstalling the program from the original install.
Although Apple's do that all right.
They do it okay, yeah. All right, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT for the Windows Upgrade Show. Groovehouse?
Yes.
See, we have a call in the queue.
Yes, we do.
We have plenty of open lines. We invite you to call in if you want to be on the air with us tonight, 713-526-5738. Who do we have up?
All right, up next, we are going to speak with Hayden.
Hayden, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Oh, I'm so excited, Jay.
Are you?
Hey, okay, here's the deal. All right, bear with me. I had to get a, you know, upgraded to a printer, and I wanted to get one of the, a Wi-Fi printer. And pick Epson. So I got Epson, and I have a really nice Lenovo, you know, kick butt Lenovo that's got an AMD, and it went in there okay. And I have an older Lenovo, that's only two gig on the RAM, but it's an older little T41, and it went in there and it was doing fine. Everything was working, and then it started dropping off, and I'd have to go back and reload with the disk. Well, I got so mad one night, I guess maybe I'd had too many, you know, a couple beers or something. So I just said, I just crunched the printer, threw it out because it was like, you know, $99. Because I was so mad it would never keep, it started happening over and over and over. Well, I can't get that Epson out of my either computer. There's still some Epson that I cannot remove. I went and bought a Canon, would not allow me to go to even recognize the printer. Because Epson, and I think because Epson corrupted my computer, took that printer back and went and bought an HP wireless, a really nice 6600 series HP the other day from Wally. And I have a brand new Toshiba that it saw the printer. It actually sees the printer, but I can't Wi-Fi that printer. I have to hook it with a patch cord USB. And on that great Lenovo, that my wife's Lenovo printer or computer, that's a great computer, it keeps telling me can't see all the download drivers. It doesn't even see that printer. It doesn't even see it. I go through the whole download process with the CD, and it won't even see the darn thing. It's like something got corrupted, and I don't know what to do now. I can't even print anymore.
I think because the original printer died a violent death, it's come back and it's haunting your workstations and your laptops. It's
who Epson?
Yeah, it's a dire situation.
How do I get it out of there?
Well, I think Barrett's being
sorry. I'm sorry.
So you bought a new HP printer, and it's wireless, right?
Yeah, it's Wi-Fi. The Canon wouldn't. Oh my God. The Canon was so difficult. I've never seen stupider directions. It was the most convoluted directions I've ever seen. Canon was horrible.
All right,
that was horrible.
All right, so let me have a chance to talk to what you've brought up here. So you've got an HP printer, and you've connected it to your Wi-Fi network, and we know it works because your wife's computer prints to it just fine.
No, hers won't. The Lenovo will not.
The Toshiba does.
When you go to print and it pops up, which printer do you want to use? It doesn't even see the 6600. It's still seeing the old 5-year-old printer that we did that wasn't even Wi-Fi. It still sees that old HP, but it won't even, and it still sees the Epson. It doesn't even see the new printer. But my new Toshiba little satellite that I bought the other day, which is, I can't believe I got it from from Best Buy for $240, and it does. It'll go up to 16 gig RAM. It's a lovely.
Get to your point.
It sees the 60 when you go in there to print, and it says what printer do you want? You know, well, yeah, there's the 6600.
In my experience,
but it won't do it Wi-Fi.
All right, listen. If you're not going to let me talk, we're going to hang up on you, okay? Because that's how that works. in my experience with installing a printer, especially like an HP wireless printer, you know, you get the, you go to the printer, you follow the instructions. The new HP printers have been really good with their instructions. You go to the printer, you read the instructions, says, okay, do this, this, and that, and you get it connected to your Wi-Fi. Boom. Okay. Once it's connected to the Wi-Fi and you've had success doing that, then there's a process you go through with the computer where you have to install the software on the computer and have it, you know, so it can see a wireless printer on the network. If you're running into a problem where it doesn't see that printer Wi-Fi on the network, it could be because either the firewall is blocking it or you're missing something. The nice thing about new HP printers, too, is that they come with tech support from HP. So you're like, if you're having trouble getting it to work properly, you can call them up and they'll go through
whatever. It's not HP. It's some kind of offbeat. It's some kind of secondary person that is Arcola or something weird. The disk doesn't even say HP. It's some other company doing the software to put into the computer.
But you bought the printer. It's an HP printer, right?
Yeah, but the disk.
I don't care. HP supports their hardware.
But there's no phone number to call them.
There isn't?
No.
Where did you look?
There's no phone number anywhere to even give them a call.
Where'd you look?
I've been all over this thing, man.
Did you go online? Did you look on the internet?
Did you try? I didn't Google that part.
Well, if you Google search.
Let me ask you this. Okay, you said, the firewall has been mentioned a few times before.
So you want to make sure that that's disabled, turned off. If you're running any of your own personal security software, even antivirus sometimes.
I have Trend Micro on it.
Disable it.
I go in and disable it. Just like take it out, or how do I disable my Trend Micro?
Wow. Okay. You go down, you find the Trend Micro icon. You can usually right click it and select disable or turn off or. What you need to do is you need to find the HP support number. And it's out there. If I Google it, I'm going to find it, and you can do this. I know you know how to use a computer at least enough to browse the web because you've been on the internet before, right?
All right.
So go on Google, contact HP. Wow, I found it right there. Wow. Support. I mean, I did a Google search on HP support number. The first link that comes up has got some 800 numbers that you can call.
Well, they don't have it in the instructions.
Well, no, but weird? You know, that's what the internet's for. They don't tend to print out too much great documentation anymore because they have it all online. But this right here, what I'm finding, unfortunately, the first one I found seems to be mostly directed at their PCs. But if I scroll down, you'll find it, and you can go and you can call them up, and you'll talk to somebody, and you say, "Look, I just want to get my printer set up," and they will help you get it set up. Because you've got a brand new printer that comes with support on it, and they will help you get it connected to your network and get you printing on it.
Well, it's hooked up to the network. It's hooked up to my router,
right. But
it just says the printer and the computer don't see each other for some reason.
Well, you can also use Google to search for disable firewall, disable. Mm-hmm. Trend Micro, you'll find.
I get that Epson crap off of there? Because it keeps saying all this Epson stuff. I think Epson corrupts.
Do you know how to use? Do you know how to use add or remove programs?
Yeah, but it won't take it off. It won't. It does nothing. I took all this Epson off, and then there's still a little bit. I don't remember what it is. I'm not sitting in front of it, but there's like two things that are Epson that will not come off that computer.
Google search completely remove Epson printer driver, and Epson.com offers a website that says how to uninstall, reinstall your printer driver.
All right.
There's steps that you have to take and to get rid of it all. I've struggled somewhat with printer software before because like your antivirus and other software programs, they'll load software when you boot the computer because a lot of these printers come with this extra software that monitors the ink and tells you when you need to buy supplies and so forth. And that stuff runs in the background, and if it's running, it can't be uninstalled easily. So sometimes you have to...
That's exactly right.
You go and you find that, and you turn it all off. You find any Epson software, and exit out of it, make sure you've quit the software, and then try to run the uninstaller. But there's a complete web, you know, Epson offers really detailed instructions for how to dig that printer driver out and get rid of it. And, you'll find everything you're looking for. Just, you know, breathe deep, use a little patience, use the internet to your advantage. You will find out how to do it. And with that HP printer, I'm not a huge HP fan, but they have really kind of fine tuned the whole thing, and they're not that hard to get going. But when you do run into problems, you have access to their support line if you can find it. No, it's not typically printed on the paper. But also make sure you go back and revisit the instructions that came with the printer and make sure you're doing everything that, you know, they say, and retrace your steps, you know. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you verify that the printer's actually online, and if it has an update, like the one that I just bought last year, I had to update some software, and it downloaded software right from the internet when I ran the update right on the printer, and that helped out with some other issues I was having. So, but call HP. Don't be afraid to call the manufacturer and ask for help with their product that you paid good money for.
Okay. Well, right? I sure appreciate it, man. It's really frustrating because we have to, like, email the Toshiba, and then the Toshiba is USB'd to the printer. That's the process we have to go through now to print something.
All right. Well, good luck. Appreciate your
Bye.
Call tonight.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
You could also Google how to share a printer.
Yeah.
Because you could share the printer from the Toshiba to the other devices.
That's true, too. If you have the Toshiba hooked up to the HP, but it kind of defeats the purpose of having a wireless printer.
Yep.
But if it came down to it, and while you're trying to sort these other issues out, you could just share the printer on the network.
Yeah.
Wireless printers are funky because you've got to have them on the same Wi-Fi network as your home router, and a lot of people will get that kind of confused.
How do they get that confused?
If you don't, a lot of people just turn it on. I've seen, like, we have people that'll bring in wireless printers and put them under their desks thinking I'll just run my own little print shop. And if it's not the same SSID, your wireless laptop can either see the network that can get an internet access, or it can see the network that the wireless printer's on. So it's got the wireless printer has to associate with the same network, so it can be accessible.
But most people only in their home situations only have the one network.
Yeah, but they still have to match.
They have to get the printer on the wireless network.
The printer has to be on the wireless network. Because a lot of times the printers...
You think
they're
just turning it on and expecting it's going to join with whatever
network? No, and it does, though. It does sometimes. So I know the new HPs, you just turn them on. It'll, like, put up an ad hoc network to where if you associate with that, you can print to it directly.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So the printer itself acts like a wireless access point. So you're making a direct connection to the printer to print.
Yeah, but so chances are, like, if his wife's computer was being able to print, I would be curious as to see if it could get on the internet, to see if it could see the internet, because it could just be associated just with the printer
Have
and not with...
Have you really seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the default. It's just recently, it's the default mode. All these super cheap, you know, under $100 printers that are wireless now, that's what they do. They spit out an ad hoc network. They say, join me. And then that's how you usually do the setup of the printer. But if you just go to print, start printing, that's what you get. So
you got it, yeah.
So you want to make
it's local to just the printer.
So you want to that kind of validates what I was saying about go back to the documentation, make sure that you're following the steps to get the printer joined to your home network, and it will usually, like, mine popped up and said I see this SSID, which was my wireless access point, so I joined it. It asked me for the password. I typed in the password, and it connected.
You typed that into the printer, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, putting it on the control panel. There's he didn't read some directions.
There's also some tricks that sometimes their software does when you run it that hooks you up to the printer and then sends the settings to the printer and then reboots the printer or reboots the network portion of the printer. To me, the best way you can see if it's on your network is either you can get on your router and see if the Mac ID is on your list of devices.
For scan for devices, yeah.
Most of them have either a port 80 or a port 443 administrative interface. And so you can get your computer on the network where you can go to Google or go to Yahoo or whatever, and then see if you can go to the IP address and pull the printer admin interface up over the network. Because otherwise
I can't remember what I had to go through with mine, but I remember it being incredibly simple. Not just because I know what I'm doing simple, but because the instructions were very clear
I think the HP ones, a lot of times what it'll say is if you want it to be on your network, they want you to hook the printer into a laptop directly with the USB cable.
Yep. You might.
And then run the software to do the setup over the USB cable, then disconnect the USB cable, and it should be joined to your network.
Right. I don't even think I had, I don't recall if I had even hooked this thing up to my computer. I think it, the interface on the printer itself has a little touch screen on it.
Oh, but the super cheapies don't have the buttons, and you have to jump through a couple other hoops, because you were able to tell directly your printer, hey, this is my...
It actually had a touch screen where you could enter
things. Yeah, this is my SSID, this is my password, go get on there, and then everyone else
Right, so the cheaper printers might be that you have to like connect it to a USB port on your computer, run a piece of software where you tell it, here's my SSID, here's my password, join my Wi-Fi. It'll tell you whether it succeeds or not, and then when it does succeed, it tells you success because you followed the instructions. You unplug the USB, and then it becomes available to all the computers.
And the tricky part, though, is it'll also just work, too, if you don't do that. So a lot of people fall into that false sense, oh, I've got my printer working having it getting on the home network.
You just plug it in, and it will work because it creates an ad hoc network.
Yeah.
Because some of them probably try DHCP.
Yeah.
But then you're still relying on some weird stuff because – it's doing DHCP, so it's not going to get a consistent IP address every time. So your desktop has to scan for it to find it and figure out what IP it is. And then it's going to use Bonjour or whatever the Windows version, and I forgot what it's called, but where it can go find it every time because the IP might be changing, because when the printer reboots, it could come up with a different IP address over DHCP.
Mine has been so flawless.
You probably got that. You probably spent enough money to where, you know, you're up in that range of where it just works nicely. And having that access pad with a little display on the printer is nice too.
Yeah, but my Windows computers and both my Macs, all three of my Macs connect to it, no problem. The iPads connect to it, no problem. It just shows up. It's there. And I leave it on. It's one of the few electronic devices that my wife lets me leave on all the time because it goes into its little sleep mode. But everything can print to it. It's always there. So,
does it air print? You use air print with iPads? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't print that often with them, but it's nice to have. And but I recall that the instructions were very straightforward. They tell you step by step, like the way that they did with all the new Cisco router. I mean, the Linksys routers and so forth. They're like step one, step two, step three. What do you want to do? So, when you're buying new technology, if you're buying something brand new, the manufacturer support, it's a hassle to get on the phone with these people, and it takes a little time, but, man, that's all they do. That's their job. If it's not broken, I mean, if the whole thing is working, they're going to be able to tell you, okay, click this,
this. They might be able to.
HP is pretty good because they do very much like, you know, consumer home-based products. They're used to dealing with old people. I'll call them all the time, not so much to get tech support, but just say, hey, can you print this for me? Because that's faster.
All right, 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight. We still have plenty of open lines and some time left, so we'd be happy to take your call at 713-526-KPFT. But next up, who is it, Groovehouse?
It's Alon.
Alon, Alon.
How's it going?
It's all right. How are you?
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'm aware that I don't have any mobile devices, iPad, iPhone, whatever. I am aware that there are methods of synchronizing them. And similarly to that, I would like to know your advice about doing that between desktop and laptop computers. I've got a Mac Mini OS X 10.6.8, and I recently acquired a MacBook Pro Retina with 10.8.5 on it. I haven't yet figured out how to hook them up to each other with various cables and the Thunderbolts and all that kind of stuff.
Well, what are you wanting to do? I mean, exactly what are you trying to
accomplish? I would like to make each computer as much as possible a mirror of the other, especially, bookmarks for the...
well, the best thing to do with the...
But also for the files I have that are basically for reference purposes.
Well, the thing is that you're not really going to so much make one computer a clone of the other. You want to make certain things accessible to both computers. So a lot of your modern browsers like Chrome and Firefox, the newer versions, the most recent, even this has actually been around for several years, your bookmarks can be stored in the cloud. And you have an account that you log into. Like if you get Google Chrome, for example, that synchronizes with your Gmail account. So you can log into Google Chrome, and all your bookmarks are available on any device that you log into Google Chrome with. So you have all your bookmarks available.
Your tabs can even follow you around now. So you like log into like one device, and you've got like, like four tabs open. You shut that down, you log into another machine, and those four tabs, whatever you're looking at on the web browser in Chrome, they follow you.
You don't even have to close. You don't even have to close.
You have to close it.
Like,
I was just saying, like, I was being power conservative.
I have like a laptop and a desktop at home and a desktop at work, and if they're all synchronized, then on any of the device I'm sitting on, I can actually see what tabs I have open on the other two and pull up that tab.
So that would solve your bookmark issue.
Well, I was going to say, with Apple specific, if you just use an iCloud account with your Apple ID, either if you have a .me or a .mac account, or if you just create one with your own email address, because it doesn't have to, an Apple ID doesn't have to be .me or .mac, it can
right.
be whatever. If you create that and then you use that for iCloud, you get a certain amount of iCloud for free, right?
Right.
And so Gmail, I haven't done much of anything in the cloud, so to speak.
Yeah, but this doesn't.
I prefer to keep all my apps and files on my computer, but if that's the way to go, then I'll just have to break down my resistance and use the iCloud.
That's the easiest way to synchronize any of your Apple stuff, like your Safari bookmarks and stuff will synchronize through that. All of your contacts will synchronize through that. All of your calendar stuff will synchronize through that. And any device, iPhone, iPad, laptop, desktop, that you sign in to that Apple ID, and you can choose to turn it on or off, or individually turn them on or off, you can synchronize all those things across all those devices.
But I would still have to manually copy over updates to the non-Apple applications files that I've created.
Well, if you're working on a file, for example, you're working on a document file, and you want that document to be in its latest greatest form available on another computer. If your storage is a cloud drive, you know you're using the cloud to upload it into that storage, then you're going to and you access it from any computer, then you will always have access to the latest version rather than copying that file from one computer and back to the other computer. Another option, if you're not convinced to use the cloud for that kind of purpose, you can have a network storage system. You can have a network drive where you have
I do have a 3 terabyte external drive that I'm using my Time Machine from a Mac Mini.
Right, but that's only accessible to the computer that's hooked up to it. So the idea of network storage is that you have a hard drive that is visible to any computer on the network. So
but
that
you have to be able to get to that network.
If you're out in the field running around, you won't see those files.
Unless you can connect back
to your home network.
Your home network. So if you put it in the cloud, that's
all
the
you
simplest,
need is internet access.
iCloud gives you a certain limited, so you couldn't put all your files in there, but you could put some photos or files or whatever. You can also look at using Dropbox for that kind of functionality, and you can also look at using Google Drive for that kind of functionality.
And you can always do your own encryption before you move those files up there if you want to be really paranoid. Like if you really don't trust the cloud, if you want your data to remain yours, just encrypt the files before you upload them.
Okie doke.
All right, thanks for your call.
Ciao.
Bye. All right.
Yeah, unfortunately for him, you know, the more recent, the newer, if you've got OS X Mavericks and you set up the iCloud account with your, you know, with when you set up your OS on any given machine, it does a whole lot of the kind of synchronizing that he's looking to do, or makes it really, really easy. But with 10.6 and older stuff, then he has to make, you know, direct efforts himself to do it.
Yep.
All right.
Where it just comes along for the ride automatically. And iCloud has been getting better. Apple's been using the cloud well to let settings and bookmarks and that kind of stuff propagate around between multiple machines.
713-526-5738. We still got about 11 minutes left in the show. We got a call in the queue. We'll probably get another call or two. If you want to call in, 713-526-5738.
I'll say one of my favorite Google Drive tricks that I've used a couple times is there's a Windows format that's an XML file that's kind of like Word document, but it's not. I forgot, it's XPS or whatever. And for years, nothing could really read that except Windows computers. Or you had to buy software for Linux or for Apple to be able to read those. It's almost like a PDF format, but it's actually a zip file with stuff in it, kind of like DocX or all the XLSX and all those newer styles. But Google Drive, you can actually upload XPS files into Google Drive, and it can read them, and then you can write them out as a PDF. Or print them directly from Google Drive. So I've used that a couple times to get around not being able to, because I don't have Windows machines. It's a new file converter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who do we have up next?
Up next on the show, we are going to speak with Nia.
Nia, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi. My question and then a resource. The computer I have is old.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave me a message that said, primary hard drive is found. And keyboard failure. What does that mean? It doesn't sound like it means anything good.
It doesn't mean anything good.
Sounds like it's giving up.
Unless stuff's loose, possibly your keyboard's loose.
Did you possibly happen to move it around recently from one location to another?
Yes, I did.
Is it a desktop or a laptop?
It's a desktop. It's a desktop Dell.
But you moved it before this happened?
Yes.
Did you unplug the keyboard when you moved it by any chance?
Yes.
Did you plug the keyboard back in correctly?
Yes, I've tried several times.
Is it color? Is it color coded? Is it like do you have one of the little purple keyboard connectors?
Is it circular? Is the keyboard connector circular, or is it USB, or do you know?
Rectangular or circular?
Circular.
Circular. You need to double check that the pins didn't get bent on that.
Ah, okay.
Sometimes the old style PS2 keyboards have like a series of about 8 or 9 pins on the inside.
I think it's 5. Sure. It might be more than that.
But if you're not careful when you plug that back in, sometimes those pins get bent. But the hard drive not found. That could be that the hard drive itself has failed, but it's also possible that a cable came loose
that
when you
moved it.
Did it take a bump or anything, or were you anything other than extremely gingerly careful when you moved the actual box that the computer is contained in?
I was pretty careful, although I had a back injury recently, so I had to choose.
Something may have become unseated, I'm thinking, but I would like to get a keyboard on there just so you could hit F1 to see if you can go any further, because it could be like a BIOS thing where you can go in and rescan, or it could be something, but maybe
so
get the keyboard fixed
F1,
first.
When I follow the instructions and hit F1, nothing really happens, and then I hit F, it says hit F2 to run the setup utility, and then I get confused.
Okay, so at least it's receiving keyboard input.
So the keyboard does seem to be working.
The keyboard seems to be working.
Like you press buttons and things happen.
Yeah, so I got past the keyboard failure. And then it says, first it was saying primary drive not found, primary drive 0, primary drive 1. Then I screwed up, and then it was secondary drive 0, and I don't know what all that means.
Well, here's the situation. It's either you're lucky but kind of unlucky that a cable came loose, but that means somebody's got to go inside and review the inner workings of the computer to see if that could be reconnected. The worst case scenario is that the BIOS, I mean, there's also the possibility that the BIOS has failed. The BIOS battery has failed, so it's not retaining the information that tells it what kind of hard drive is connected.
I don't like the fact that it doesn't see the keyboard and then suddenly the keyboard works. Like, that's kind of odd, isn't it, that it's plugged in?
First, it would always come up keyboard failure.
And how old is the computer?
Really old. I wrote it down. It was donated to me. I tried to write everything down so I could find it.
I mean, approximately. Have you had it more than 5 years?
Oh, yeah. I was just trying to dump it. It has copyright 1990, 2002. Someone gave it to me in 2008.
Okay.
In 2008.
Well, if it was given to you for free and you got that much use out of it, then you did really well.
And so I think you helped me. I need the information. I hadn't backed up the, how do I get the information out?
Well, if the hard drive died, the information may be gone. But if the hard drive is still functional and it's a computer that's gone bad, then the drive could be connected to a new computer and the data could be recovered. But you're going to need somebody who knows what they're doing to do that for or help you with that.
Yeah, it could be fairly simple. Or if the hard drive failed, you would have to pay somebody to recover it.
Well, I'm thinking that you're probably going to have to pay somebody just to open the computer up and remove the drive. But conceivably, you could open the computer, take the hard drive out, plug it up to a cable that would allow you to connect it to the USB port of a new computer.
I bet Dwight would love to do that at the Geek Gathering.
I was going to ask, where should I go and how much should I pay for something like that?
Unfortunately, they really get you on that kind of stuff.
I knew that. because they know I need that information.
Do you have a technically inclined relative or neighbor or anything like that?
No.
Well, I know that places like Micro Center and Fry's do that. You're going to probably pay, $100. They might offer a service to do the transfer of data. If you buy a new computer, you might talk to them about that.
Well, they troubleshoot and just tell her if her drive is dead or not for free, or is that a service? Is that like a bench charge or something?
It's going to be at least a $20 or $50.
$20 to $50 bench charge easily.
Micro Center is a place. I know Fry's.
Micro Center and Fry's are good. They might be an option for you. I would try one of them before I went to a Best Buy.
Computer hospital or?
Computer hospital might be a little expensive.
I was working with a law firm and I needed a letter of representation and they sent something that I couldn't open and then it just, it's like a label or their logo, it just stuck to my computer. What is that called? I'm not computer.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Or a PDF.
I don't know what you're referring to. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Okay, thanks for your help.
All right, good luck. Thank you for your call.
Bye-bye.
All right, well, another episode of Technology Bites in the can. And next week, fundraiser, if you're listening in Houston. I'll probably do repeat or rerun of another show for the syndicates that aren't in fundraiser. But I hope you'll tune in next week and give us money and enjoy your week off. All right, you've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
See you next week.
Do you or someone you know own a local dining establishment? KPFT has a pledge drive coming up. And each drive, restaurants in the area feed our phone volunteers who give of their time to help KPFT reach its goals. Donations of food by these establishments are tax deductible and help community radio in the process. We also thank your establishment on air. Call 713-526-4000 for more information on how Houston eateries can lend a helping hand to KPFT. Ideal locations will be close to downtown Houston and be able to provide meals for 12 hungry volunteers. Again, that's 713-526-4000 for more information. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio, kpft.org, twitter.com/kpft, facebook.com/kpft Houston.
In 2008, veterans and active duty service members joined together to form March Forward. March Forward's aim is to unite all those who have served and who currently serve in the U.S. military. March Forward organizes against war while fighting for social and economic justice at home, including the struggle against all forms of discrimination. March Forward operates based on the belief that real change comes through mass action. You can learn more about March Forward, its campaigns, conscientious objection, and much more at marchforward.org. You are listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1, kpft.org.